You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, an oral history project is collecting the accounts of people who participated in Milwaukee's housing marches 50 years ago.
First, it's time for a weekly look at some of the biggest Wisconsin news stories. GOP primaries for the two special legislative elections were held. We'll find out who came out on top and who they'll face in the general election.
Wisconsin taxpayers footed a bill for Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, two of his GOP colleagues and their staffers to go to Ohio last year to attend a news conference.
And Wisconsin parents can sign up online for a new child tax credit that was approved as part of the state's biennial budget.
Robert Menser joins us to dig into those stories and more. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So let's start out with these GOP primaries for the special elections. Remind us what led to these special elections being called.
Yeah, so these were created by vacancies when Governor Scott Walker appointed a couple of Republicans to positions in his administration. And you will recall this was the subject of some debate earlier this year, because they were the Walker and Republicans didn't want to have these special elections. They preferred to have this, like, just do this in the fall. But the courts and the law eventually said, no, you have to have special elections here. That whole argument delayed things to the point where we're going to end up having special elections just a couple months before the fall election.
And the primary was this week, and the general is next month. It's coming up really fast.
Yeah, it's June 12th.
And so the GOP did held their primaries for those two seats on Tuesday. What were the results? Who came out on top?
Sure. Well, the sort of probably the more interesting one is the first Senate district, which is like Green Bay and some of that area up to Door County as well. A Republican state representative, Andre Jacques, won in that race against an opponent, Alex Renard, who is a businessman. And what's sort of interesting there is that Jacques, despite being an incumbent state representative, was not the pick of the sort of like Republican establishment. Republican leadership had endorsed Renard. Hmm. Jacques is he's a social conservative. He's animated by social issues. So he's been an outspoken opponent for protections for people who are transgender, or, you know, these are sort of his issues.
Abortion has been a big issue for him as
well. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anti-abortion politician. So I think it's the case that state Republican leaders, Governor Scott Walker on down, would rather be talking about tax cuts and business policies. But at any rate, I mean, at least in this race, Jacques had the edge, and immediately after he won, every Republican leader said that they endorse him and mm-hmm. will support him for the general.
And how about that second race?
Yeah, the second race is down in South Central Wisconsin in the 42nd Assembly District, and a town board member named John Plummer will face Democrat Ann Groves Lloyd. They're both of Lodi.
And was that any surprise that he came out on top?
Well, it was a bigger race. There were four candidates in that race. He's a town board member. He has a karate studio down there. It's always a little harder to predict when it's a whole bunch of candidates like that. Mm-hmm. But I think Republicans seem pleased enough with that outcome.
So both of these open seats had been held by Republicans who then were given appointments in the Walker administration. Earlier this year, we saw a seat change from Republican to Democrat because of a special election. Are there any predictions on what might happen next month when it's a general election and someone's elected actually to the seat?
Right. I mean, well, you know, look, some people, Judith, are cynical and say that this might have had something to do with why Walker didn't want to hold these special elections in the first place, is that the trend in Wisconsin and nationwide has been that Democrats have been really doing very, very well in special elections this year and have been outperforming. And so, I think it's very, very much in play, especially the Senate race, the state Senate race, should be very much in play in the June 12th general election. Now then we'll just do it again in the fall. So
true.
Who knows? I think it's one to they're both good to watch.
Let's move on. This week we learned that Wisconsin taxpayers ended up footing a bill for Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Two of his GOP colleagues and their staffers to go to Ohio last year was a single-day trip to attend a news conference. How unusual is that, Rob?
It's pretty unusual. I mean, generally, legislators don't use the state plane. The governor uses it all the time. This governor and previous governors use that to travel around, do news conferences in different parts of the state, or visit different sites. But in this case, Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, had only used it once before, and it really is unusual, if not unprecedented, to use it to travel out of state.
And how much did the trip cost?
So this was they billed the taxpayers $4,300 for this day trip to give a news conference in Ohio. This was with Voss and Representatives Mike Rohrkast of Neenah and Tyler Vorpagel of Plymouth.
And what have we heard from Speaker Voss or those other legislators about this, whether this is something that they feel they need to address or not?
Sure. Well, Voss defends the substance of the conference, basically. The purpose of this, they were talking about the importance of federalism and of giving states the power to address problems, like opiate crisis and other problems. So Voss's position is that this was worthwhile and was in the interest of the public in Wisconsin because those are policies that he supports. I mean, the reason why this is notable or the reason why this is interesting is it's just part of, it shows the closeness, the close ties Voss had with this Ohio speaker, this Ohio legislator named Cliff Rosenberger, who has resigned now from office in the middle of news that he's under investigation by the FBI into a bunch of, corruption charges, essentially, fancy trips and apartments.
Right,
and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. For questionable travel,
Yeah, questionable travel, right, exactly. So it turns out Voss was very good friends with this guy. This may have been reported. I noticed it in this week's story that Rosenberger was best man at Voss's wedding last year. That's close. They're buddies. And so it has caused reporters to start looking at Voss's travel habits and times he was together with this guy, traveled with this guy, went on a lobbying-funded trip or whatever.
Hmm. Well, certainly sounds like there might be more coming out on that. We're taking our weekly look back at some of the top Wisconsin news stories with Rob Menser. He's statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Rob, this week, Wisconsin parents were able to apply online for a new child tax credit. Remind us how that came about.
Sure. So Republicans passed this into law this year. And this week, Governor Scott Walker was traveling around the state to promote the sign-up period for this. Yeah, $100 per child for any kid 18 years old and under, born anytime before December 31st, 2017.
And who's eligible to apply for it? Is it really anyone, or are there certain income restrictions?
Anyone. Go sign up. So you have until July 2nd to sign up. You'll get a check or a direct deposit sometime this summer. There's a state website for it. This is going to end up costing the state about $122 million. It is not a small expense to the state, but Walker and Republicans' argument is that the economy is growing. The money, there's a surplus, by some accounting at least, and so this is a way of giving back some money to Wisconsin residents. There are some others who see this as sort of a political ploy, but I guess it can be maybe it can be both.
And is this a one-time thing, or will this continue in future years?
This is a one-time thing.
So people should get on there and apply by July 2nd. And finally, good news, maybe, for movie buffs, MoviePass is coming to Wisconsin. What's that?
Yeah, so this is kind of all the rage now, and it was getting some attention this week. So this is a new startup, and you pay a flat fee of $10 per month, and then you can see as many movies as you want, at least one per day, at theaters that participate, which is like most theaters, like Marcus Theaters does it, AMC Theaters have it. So it's kind of an amazing deal if you see movies at all, since usually just one
ticket
costs $10 or more, you know.
So I'm not an economist, but that seems like a hard business model to make money on, since people might spend $30 or $40 a month on movies to see three or four instead of 10. So how is MoviePass doing financially?
Terrible. Your instincts are correct. This is kind of what's funny. The other thing the company announced this week is that it lost $98.3 million in the last quarter on $48.6 million of revenue.
Wow.
So the business model is they go and buy tickets and they just eat the losses. So it's like very unclear what the business plan is here. But I guess if you like movies, it's a good deal to you. The best comment I think was a tweet from the writer Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, who wrote, "Right now, MoviePass isn't a business so much as a late capitalist welfare program that redistributes hundreds of millions of dollars from venture capital to subsidize American leisure."
Well, there you go.
Which is nice.
I can't think of a better place to leave it, Rob. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly look at news stories from around the state. Hundreds of Milwaukeeans took to the streets 50 years ago to fight for fair housing, marching from the city's north side to its south side. The Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council and its supporters marched for 200 consecutive nights between August 1967 and March 1968 to get an open housing law enacted.
Now, an effort by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and several other organizations is making sure the stories of those marchers aren't forgotten.
Will Chakaritis joins us now to talk about the project. He's the Oral History Committee Chair for March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary and a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
How significant an event in Milwaukee history and in U.S. civil rights history were these marches?
Yeah, this is something that I think we need to remind people. Milwaukee was central to the open housing movement in America. Our NAACP Youth Council and their advisor, Father Grappi, led a series of marches for 200 days straight between 1967 and 1968. It was August to March. And they really showed a certain level of determination in working towards their cause. It was a broadly popular movement within the city's African-American communities and among their allies, but it was also a movement that saw vehement counterinsurgency and counter-protests. So it was a violent struggle in a lot of ways.
Hmm. And Will, the March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary organization is working on collecting and documenting the stories of those original marchers. How are you doing that? How are you finding these people, first of all?
Yeah, well, let me first say that this is a really special project. It's a cross-institutional partnership between several different archives and historical organizations in the area. Kristen Leffelman at the Wisconsin Historical Society, Abby Nye and Heidi Anosko at the UW-Milwaukee Archives, Claiborne Benson at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, Kevin Abing at the Milwaukee County Historical Society, and myself as a PhD student at UWM. We're all coming together to kind of pool resources, test our connections, and see who we can, what voices we can lift up within our community in Milwaukee that maybe haven't been heard yet.
And how are you finding those people?
So we're reaching out through different listservs around the city. Let me give you an example. Our last History Harvest, this is where we actually go out into the community and collect people's stories, was held at Marquette University's Raynor Memorial Library. We tapped into listservs at retirement communities, within the Catholic Church, within Marquette University. And for this specific harvest, we were trying to gather stories from individuals within the Marquette community and the Catholic Church community, and perhaps even some white counter-protesters if they were interested, but we didn't see very much turnout on that end.
Hmm. It also seems like there are certainly some people who are still in the area after 50 years, but many, I'm sure, have moved to other parts of the state or the country. Are there any efforts to be able to reach some of those people?
Yeah, and some have even passed on, obviously.
Sure.
This was 50 years ago. Yeah, efforts have been made. And I think through social media, say Twitter or Facebook, some individuals across the country have seen that we were doing this project, and they actually reached out to the Wisconsin Historical Society, and some interviews have been conducted remotely.
You're really going for the everyday people. I'm sure people who would be the first to call themselves just ordinary people. As a historian, yeah, and as part of this project, why is it important to talk to those everyday people?
Because these were the people on the ground really making this change happen. A lot of this organization took place away from the spotlight, outside of the halls of politics, in the basement of churches, took place in community centers, with different social justice, racial justice organizations around the city. We really want to focus through this whole project more broadly in centering the voices of youth who are engaged in the struggle at this time. That includes a lot of women as well, who often do not get, are not honored quite in the same way as some of those heroic civil rights figures, mm-hmm, even at the local level, like Father Grappi.
Will Chakoritis is with us right now. He's part of the Oral History Committee for the March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary Project. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And Will, what is it like for you to hear these stories, to hear these memories of people who were involved in this really significant struggle 50 years ago?
Oh, it's so powerful. I mean, where to begin? I've been studying Milwaukee's civil rights history now for almost 10 years, and with each voice that we add to a project like this, I learn something new about that struggle. These are really felt emotional experiences for each individual involved, and it's touching, it's inspiring, it's energizing. I mean, part of this 200 Nights of Freedom project is to reignite this idea of protest, the idea that coming together, collectivizing, organizing, mobilizing, that this is the way that political change is really affected.
And you mentioned that one of the specific efforts is to reach out to people who were young people at the time. Do you see parallels between Milwaukee's political movements of the 1960s and political movements of today?
Oh my goodness, I do. Our second history harvest took place at the ACLU's Youth Social Justice Forum at UW-Milwaukee. And this event specifically caters to youth and youth of color in the city. And what we wanted to do was build some connections between the activism of the past and the activism that youth are doing today. And we were able to capture a lot of those stories. And you'd be amazed how much these youth actually know about this civil rights story. I think that a lot of adults could really learn something from their experiences. They're organizing for their own struggles today that are, you know, they clearly demonstrate that a lot of the issues of the late 1960s have not been resolved.
And Will, a couple times in talking about this project, you mentioned churches and church basements and faith. How much is there a faith element to why people are saying that they became involved in this movement 50 years ago?
That's a really good question. I'm no expert in the relationship between the church and the movement, but I think there's certainly something to say for how faith-based institutions bring people together, provide a forum for people to express their humanity. And a lot of these issues around civil rights that we're discussing are, these are human issues. These are people who want their humanity to be seen, and churches provide that organizational apparatus to really affect that change that they're looking for, and also a place just to kind of share at an emotional level how they are dealing with a lot of these issues, such as housing discrimination or experiencing police brutality or experiencing education discrimination, etc.
Do you have a goal of how many people's memories you're hoping to record through this oral history project?
You know, we didn't set a hard number. I would say so far we have about 26 total people interviewed across three different history harvests, and then a couple more added in those remote interviews I had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 600 minutes of interview content so far, and that includes 16 men, 10 women. And the majority of our interview subjects have been people of color.
If someone listening has a story to tell, if they say, wow, wait, I was there, I have a story to tell, how can they get in touch with you or the committee to share that?
I'm so glad you asked that. They can reach out to me directly. My email address is tchakir2@uwm.edu.
And Will, as we start to wrap up, I'm sure people like me listening are anxious to know how we'll be able to hear these stories when they're put together. What's the plan for making these accessible to people?
Certainly. So we are going to gather the rest of our interviews, and we are going to index them, assign metadata, transcriptions will be done, and we're going to sort of do that work through the Wisconsin Historical Society, and then all of our partner institutions will have copies of these interviews. Mm. And that includes UWM, and I do need to give a shout out to UWM's March on Milwaukee project. Folks can visit that project, uwm.edu/March on Milwaukee. That's a great place to learn more about this history, and I'm sure that we'll connect these interviews we're collecting for this project with that project.
Well, Will, thanks so much for sharing this with us. It's a really great story and a really fascinating project.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Will Chakoritis. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a new project collecting the stories of Milwaukeeans active in the fair housing marches 50 years ago. Perfectionism in college students is increasing. According to data that surveyed British, Canadian, and American students, perfectionism is up 33% since 1989.
A big part of perfectionism is about putting pressure on ourselves to meet high standards. Lots of people can struggle with that. Here's a clip of writer David Foster Wallace in an interview with WNYC in 1996, talking about his own struggle with chasing perfection.
You know, the whole thing about perfectionism, the perfectionism is very dangerous because, of course, if your fidelity to perfectionism is too high, you never do anything, because doing anything results, it's actually kind of tragic, because it means you sacrifice how gorgeous and perfect it is in your head for what it really is. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of years, I think, where I really struggled with that.
Jane Addams is a social psychologist, writer, and coach. She wrote a piece for the New York Times called More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Judith.
How would you define perfectionism, Jane?
Well, it's an enduring personality trait, and it is a quality that makes people need to live up to a certain standard, whether it's theirs or someone else's, to be perfect in some specific, if not every way. Perfectionism isn't usually just about college performance. If you're a perfectionist, as a student, you're probably a perfectionist in other areas of your life, too.
It seems like everyone is different, and so I'm guessing everyone's idea of what is perfect is different. How do we form those ideas and those images?
It's hard to know. It may, in fact, be constitutional and innate. It may be reinforced by your culture. In some cultures, being perfect in what you do is seen as very important. It may come from nurture as well as nature. That is, if you are brought up in a family that that celebrates achievements, particularly academic achievements. And some people, you know, it's a quality that some people have, and other people, it never shows itself. If they do have it, it's not an enduring personality trait.
You referenced this a little bit, so some of it's coming from ourselves and some of it's coming from others. Is there also a sense of perfection or what is perfect that we get from the society as a whole?
Oh, sure. One of the interesting things about that study is that it looked at three different aspects of perfectionism. And the first, which is the one that speaks to most of us, is self-perfection. You know, we set our own standards and we set them high, and we fall short if we don't live up to them. And if we have them, you know, to an overwhelming degree, we find a lot of behaviors like the one that David Foster Wallace talked about. You put things off and you procrastinate them. If you procrastinate if you're a perfectionist, because if it will never reach the image you have of it, whether it's a painting or a term paper or a novel, why would you start it?
So internally, perfectionism
Self-oriented perfection, it can in fact be paralyzing and very stressful. And I find in my I'm a coach mostly for parents of grown kids or young adults. And I found in my practice and in the practice of other colleagues that parents were coming to us in January disturbed by signs of stress that they'd noticed in their kids when they were probably closer to them in physical proximity than they had been since September. And for many of it, they seemed to ascribe it to this need to live up either to their child's own standards or to the standards of others or the standards set by social media.
Yeah, let's look at that, Jane. So social media in kind of the large sense is a very, very new phenomenon for young people. It's probably been around for most or all of their lives. But how is social media making perfectionism a different issue today than it was maybe 20, 30 years ago?
Well, 20, 30 years ago, the cultural models, whether it was slender, beautiful women, were everywhere. They were still in magazines, on TV, in movies, reinforced every way by the culture. Social media, of course, just intensified how quickly, how often we're subjected to the cultural surround. And young people are big users of social media. And, you know, you've heard of the fear of missing out, which is another social media affliction, that looking at the wonderful life that others seem to be living, whether it's an Instagram photo of, you know, a beautifully made up young woman or a Facebook post of a bunch of people you might know having a great time without you, you know, it's a different kind of pressure. And it's why the social media increase, the social oriented perfectionism has risen most sharply in the last 10 years.
Well, and I think it's interesting because certainly all those things were going on back, for instance, when I was in college. People were having great times. People were, you know, doing all the things that people today are, but we didn't see it.
It was not in our, face, and
exactly.
Certainly not in our Facebooks. And that's what's made it different, and that's why social media imposes its own kind of perfectionism, if you allow it to. And it's different, very different from self-oriented perfectionism, or even from what's broadly called socially oriented perfectionism, which is being oriented toward the standards of somebody outside yourself, your parents, your high school teachers, your professors, your admissions directors, somebody whose standards you need to meet in order to be part of that.
You know, I think back a couple decades and kind of the worst that we got faced with that was, I mean, you said TV and things like that, but it was those holiday family letters where when you would read them, it was like every child was, you know, on the verge of being a Nobel laureate and, you know. But it was once a year.
It was once a year, along with the Norman Rockwell Happy Family.
We're talking with Jane Addams. She's a social psychologist, writer, and coach. She wrote a piece for the New York Times called More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism. And Jane, you talked about working with parents a lot in your coaching practice. Can you give us some ideas of specific things that parents are noticing or what's kind of setting off alarms for them?
Well, the alarms are the either depression or procrastination or just plain short-temperedness, because you're cranky when you're procrastinating something you should be doing. But it was more the procrastination and the depression and the anxiety, you know, oh, I'll never get this done, or it's so difficult. It's not going to be, you know, nearly as good as it has to be, those kinds of messages. And you know, what parents can best do is to hear their kids, to listen to them, and to give them some worthwhile advice, which is do the best you can in the time you have. And then, you know, send them back to school and listen to them when they complain and keep reminding them that, you know, things they thought weren't good enough before were plenty good enough. Remember the SAT scores you sure you were bombing on? They got you into college.
And so it's one of the things
for that.
It's one of the things that we should maybe be focusing more on with young people instead of praising them for things that they, when they do, you know, get the top score or really rise above the crowd, is part of it praising them for, you know, maybe being a well-rounded person or for being a good friend or a good member of the family, like some of those more intrinsic values instead of everything being, you know, set with a kind of a scale of how you're doing compared to others.
Well, that's true. The other thing you can do when they say, hey, guess what? I got an A. You can say, that's terrific, honey. How do you feel about it? Because maybe she's, or I got a B. And you say, that's terrific. How do you feel about it? And if she says, I should have gotten an A, you remind her that, you know, she did the best she, if she did the best she could in the time that she had, she did a good enough job. And then send her a care package, you know. We need to understand, but unless the depression really gets almost clinically bad, that you can't function at all or get out of bed, or he, it's not anything we have to, I think, really worry about. It's a matter of understanding their perspective and easing their anxiety is the best way that we can. But I think the best response is always, that's terrific, honey. How do you feel about it? Because, or how did that make you feel, you know?
Because maybe that B was actually way better than she was expecting she was going to get, and it's a real
accomplishment. Yeah, she might have said, really surprised because I didn't study for it that much. I mean, you know, that's an open-ended question. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Jane Addams, a social psychologist, writer, and coach. She wrote a piece for the New York Times titled, More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism.
What do you think? Do you consider yourself a perfectionist? Is that a good thing in your life, or does it create problems? And are you a college student in particular struggling with this issue? Do you work in a college setting? Do you see this going on? Or if you're a parent, are you worried about your child? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We continue the conversation about the increase in perfectionism among college students. We're talking to Jane Addams, a social psychologist, writer, and coach.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you feel like you need to get things done perfectly? Are you a parent who sees it in your child? Do you think pressures to be perfect have changed in the last decade or so? And how has social media contributed to that? Share your thoughts by tweeting us at Central Time WPR.
Jane, you talk about a scale for perfectionism that you can take a brief quiz to find out where you stand. What kind of things indicate a tendency towards perfectionism?
There are a number, there are 44 items on that particular scale, ranging from I never do as well as my friends do, to other people do better than I do, to I only have to live up to my ideas. You know, they're those kinds of questions that will elicit feelings enough to be scored, feelings of perfectionism. And some will hardly register. Some will just, you know, not have enough, will have negligible amount of perfectionism in them because people are different. But for people who are perfectionists, it's a good guide on where your perfectionism is oriented toward yourself, in which case, you know, there are a number of cognitive behavioral ways to modify that so that it doesn't cause you anxiety. But generally, a certain amount of self-oriented perfectionism is what gets most students where they probably are right now. And, you know, it's generally associated with success and conscientiousness. So perfectionism to that degree is a positive thing. It's negative when it interferes with the rest of your life. And fully functioning in those other areas of your life and causes you unhappiness. This is a very competitive world that most college students live in, that we all live in. They had to struggle to get as far as they've gotten. They know they're going to have to struggle in a very competitive field to get a job when they get out. they've been struggling for a long time, and the competition is keeping them on their toes, if it's not, you know, knocking them off their feet. So it's not surprising that as society gets more competitive, that there's less room at the top or even on the way up, perfectionism would increase.
Let's take a call. Kathy in Stevens Point is up first. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I was just listening to what the speaker was saying, and my daughter is going into pre-med, so she feels like she has to get a 4.0 to be competitive to get into med school. And I've seen also some of her friends who are trying to get into nursing. That's very competitive as well, trying for the same thing so that they can make it in the field they've chosen. So I think part of this is the competition, as you said.
And Kathy, what have you as a parent found to be helpful in trying to support your daughter?
Well, I do, you know, talk to her about not needing to get, I mean, not needing to get a 4.0 is not, I don't think it's mandatory, but she seems to believe it is with a four-year plan that she was given. So,
Thanks for that call, Kathy. And Jane, does that sound familiar to you?
It sounds very familiar. I have interviewed one man who's said to his son, perfect is the enemy of good. And his son said, yeah, but good won't get me into medical school. And he's right. But again, that's other oriented. It's oriented toward a set of standards that somebody else has set. And some people will get in and some people won't. Doesn't mean that you don't meet your own standards, but your own standards need to be reasonable. And, you know, in a very competitive world, it's just very difficult not to need to be perfect if good you're afraid is just not good enough.
It also seems like it's backing up in life as well, because now it seems like there are so many expectations of high school students to show that not only do they have the grades, but they're doing volunteering and they're well-rounded, they're doing sports and maybe theater. And it seems like it's getting younger and younger that that these expectations are being presented and then internalized by young people.
That's true. They internalize them. And what we as parents can do is to offer another perspective. And to suggest that they step back and take another perspective. Like, what will this matter in the long run? What will happen if my grades aren't good enough to get into college, the college I want? What will happen if I, you know, don't get into any college? You play out the what will happen if. What's the worst thing that could happen? And that helps to some extent. But I think reminding them that in all but a very few cases, perfect is, in fact, the enemy of good.
Let's go back to the phones, and Dan in Menominee is up. Hi, Dan.
Hey. So I'm a college student at UW-Stout. I just wanted to say that with so many kids today, and me, myself included, kind of striving toward, you know, doing things right and competing with one another, it seems like we're creating a group of people who would rather be in competition with one another than work with one another. And I just don't know that that's the most constructive thing for us as a society. I'll take my call off the air.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Dan. And Jane, that's a really interesting idea that
yes,
this perfectionism
yes.
is fueling competition too.
Yeah. You know, what are you going to do when there's no more top at the ladder? I think working for your own goals, particularly in education, learning for the sake of learning is as important, as more important than learning for the sake of grades.
Let's go back to the phones, and Gail in Fish Creek is up next. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi. Well, this is a really great topic. I've encountered so many people in my journey that have really struggled with this, and there's attention to detail, and then there's something else that just gets your persona stuck. And it reminds me of a few lines in a Leonard Cohen song where it's, forget your perfect offering, ring the bells that still can ring, there is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Wow.
And if we're perfect too early in our lives, we close off, we don't grow, we don't bring more light in our life. And I really think that we reach perfection in our last breath before we die.
Wow. Well, Gail, thank you so much for sharing those lyrics and those sentiments. And Jane, there's a lot there.
There certainly is. Competition for the sake of competition is not always the end-all and be-all. There are some people who need to win at all costs. But when the costs are self-flagellation and unhappiness and always falling short of somebody's expectations, either your own or someone else's, it's nice to put competition aside and focus on what you're doing for the intrinsic value it has to you.
I'm just thinking here, Jane, that, you know, if we are striving for perfection all the time in all different areas, you know, whether it's grades in things as different as math and art and music, you know, it's the rare person that is going to be even excellent, let alone perfect, in all these different areas. How much does that affect how we are able to like and love ourselves if we're always measuring ourselves against this unattainable goal?
Oh, I think you've really put your finger on something, Judith. What we lose in an overfocus on perfectionism is self-compassion. We lose compassion for ourselves and humility to a certain extent, to know that, you know, we are only human, therefore we are imperfect.
And are we harder on ourselves than we are on others around us generally?
Yes, I think so. I think we are.
And so maybe part of it is trying to have that compassion and that gentleness and that kindness that we might extend to a good friend, extending that to ourselves.
Exactly. We're usually the last person we think of when we think about being compassionate and caring for others. Part of caring for yourself is knowing what your limits are.
And Jane, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
That was Jane Addams. She's a psychologist, coach, and writer. She joined us to talk about her piece for the New York Times titled More College Students Majoring in Perfectionism.
And you can keep the conversation going. Are you a college student struggling with this issue? Do you work in a college setting and see this or something similar? Are you a parent worried about your student away at school? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.